I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, everyone. It's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling, and I'm with a very special person who, and we're just talking about getting to know each other and the delight in that, Ann Tashi Slater. Welcome. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you, Raghu. It's such a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's so good. I'm in L.A. or near L.A., and Ann is in Tokyo. It's another day there. It's just amazing how it all works. I just want to mention something before we get going with Anne and her story, which is fascinating. We have a new partner who's helping support the Be Here Now Network. Then that's Eaton Hemp, and they actually make extraordinary CBD products. And it's something I love because it's really great for inflammation. And that's something most of us have an issue with. So it's organic, it's wonderful, they're great people, and I'm not going to go any further than that, but check them out, Eaton Hemp, and you go to the show notes, and there'll be links and a wonderful little offer if you want to buy something for the next little bit, you'll be able to get it. So just go through the show notes on Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. That's the commercial, Ann. And you have had an extraordinary life, and one of the things, and we don't know each other, so I have had a book. I mean, most of us from back in the day that were doing psychedelics and hanging out with Ram Dass, like I have done for a long, long time until he just passed. And as you mentioned in this little. It seems like the beginning of a memoir. Are you working on a memoir?
I actually just finished one. Yes.
Oh, really?
And it's very much related to the piece that you're talking about in Tricycle.
And it's going to get published soon?
Soon, yes. Yes. It's just, settling on that.
That's so
now.
Great. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, of course, you mentioned the interest in the we're talking, folks, about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, an extraordinary revealed manual for understanding the process of going through that we all are going to go through death and into, as it is completely part of the fabric of life of people from the East, which is karma and reincarnation. And this just describes that whole process. This book is so fantastic, but it's not easy to grok, shall we say. And of course, Ram Dass or Richard Alpert and Tim Leary and Ralph Metzner, they did the psychedelic experience in 64 out of their, all of the trips that they were doing. And who, what Ram Dass told me, it was recommended to them by Aldous Huxley. He told them after they described a little bit of the trip, oh, well, you got to get the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So now here's the so I've had one, Annie, that and that it's the Evans-Wentz one. And you're going to tell that whole story. But it's introduced by John Woodruff. Do you know that version of it? The
yes,
English
I think
mystic?
That's it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's some, I want to talk about a couple of things he mentions, which are really pretty far out, that were written in 1925. So, and I think you got to just start with who you are and how you came to even find the Tibetan Book of the Dead and how your family goes back to a friendship, basically, with the Lama, Kazi Dawa Samdab, who actually was the one who translated from the Tibetan. And of course, Evans-Wentz, who is, we all knew about Evans-Wentz way back in the day, you know, who is the basic author of the book with the Lama. So tell us your story. It's so great.
Thank you, Raghu. It's basically I'm a writer and I'm a professor and I'm based in Tokyo where I've lived for many years. And I grew up in New Jersey and in the Bay Area in Marin. And I grew up, my mother is Tibetan from Darjeeling and my father is American or was American from New Jersey. And I grew up very Americanized and I had been to Darjeeling once when I was 3 years old. I was born in Spain and my father was stationed at a naval base there. And I lived there for 2 years. And then my parents left me and my sister in Darjeeling with my grandparents while they got settled to work for the Peace Corps in Nepal. They were in the second group of volunteers in Nepal in 1960s. And then we left and we came to New Jersey after that. So I was Darjeeling, Kathmandu, and then to New Jersey. And Spain, Darjeeling, Kathmandu, New Jersey, and then California. And so basically from the age of three until the age, until after I graduated from college, I didn't go to Darjeeling. And not only did I not go to Darjeeling, but I didn't think about it very much. I didn't know very much about it. And my mother really tried hard for us to be American and she really wanted us to fit in. And so we weren't raised Buddhist. Instead of celebrating Buddhist holidays or Losar New Year, for example, the Tibetan New Year, we celebrated Christmas, we celebrated Easter. And she also, interestingly, was really happy to leave behind the old country, as it were. And she was very bored as a child with prayers in the altar room and this kind of thing. And she went to the United States to become a doctor and she went to Columbia. And so she was really happy to throw herself into the world of modern Western medicine and leave behind the religious or more spiritual aspects of what she'd grown up with. So I tried really hard to hide that I was part Tibetan or half Tibetan, as we said, my siblings and I, because I really, of course, wanted to fit in too, as children do. And people would often try to guess my ethnicity and they would say, oh, are you Irish? Are you Hawaiian? Are you? And then if I said I was born in Spain, they'd say, oh, that's it, Spanish. And I'd say, right, that's right, Spanish. Because I really there were almost no Asians or Asian Americans when I was growing up in American suburbia. There just weren't. It's very different from how it is now. And so I thought, and then people thought I was Chinese. And again, I didn't change or correct that, because I thought, well, at least that was known. Whereas, remember, in the 1960s, the Dalai Lama had really just come out of Tibet. Yeah. And so he wasn't at all on the radar of the world the way he is now. So I worked really hard to hide it. And the only problem, of course, is that I never could fit in terms of how I looked. And so the camouflage was only partial, and I still looked really different. And so in any event, I went on like this, and wishing that I had blonde hair and blue eyes and could fit in more with the you know, group around me.
Yeah, and you were watching Bewitched too.
I was.
Bewitched and listening to Santana. That's right.
You remember those days on the green, the concerts in the Oakland Coliseum? So yeah,
I was out there too at that time. Just as a funny aside, I have a friend, Krishna Das. I'm not sure if you know who he is. He's does a chant around the world. He's part of Ram Das and Krishna Das and others that you may know. We were together in India with Neem Karoli Baba back in the day. And so we were introduced to Hanuman there. And then he tells a funny story. Look, these people grew up with Hanuman. And what did we grow up with? Mickey Mouse. That's right. Bewitched, Mickey Mouse. You know, that's what we grew
up
with. You know.
That's Sorry right. I dream of Jeannie. You know, that was that whole era.
You wonder. Well, sorry.
No, I remember that very well. And so that whole era was like that. And then I went to college and I majored in French and Latin American literature and comparative literature. And my dream was to be a writer in Paris. And that's what I was going to do. And I'm a great Francophile, and I studied French for many years, and I took a gap year in Paris after high school to work as an au pair. And so I graduated from college, and it was funny. Something happened where I felt really kind of lost. You know, I lost my sense of forward direction that I really had very strongly, and that had propelled me through high school and through college and all my different things that I wanted to do. And I think part of it was that, in a sense, there were no more hoops to jump through. You know, when I was in college, I could like write this paper, or I could try to win that prize, or I could, you know, do this project, or I was very, very, I loved all the academic work in college. And then that was gone. And there I was with my life ahead of me and my future. And I wasn't planning to go to graduate school or anything like that. And I thought, I'll just say, go be a writer. And I felt like something was missing. And so I did an about face in the other direction and went east to India. And so I guess I'm still on my way to Paris. I never, and something drew me to Darjeeling. And my Tibetan grandfather had recently died. My grandmother was alone, and I decided to go there and spend some time with her. And that's what started this journey for me of this excavation of my family history and of myself. And then eventually led me to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And you asked about our family connection to the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah. Your great-grandfather, I think, yeah.
Right. It was my great-grandfather, and he was a very, he worked very closely with the 13th Dalai Lama, and he was a diplomat and police officer in Darjeeling. So Evans Wentz came to Darjeeling, and my great-grandfather gave him a letter of introduction to Lama Kazi Zamdub in Sikkim, in Gangtok. He was in Gangtok. Mm. And so Evans went one rainy morning with this letter in his pocket to Gangtok. And that's how they met and started working together on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that is the edition that came out in 1927 that was published by Oxford. And interestingly, because I doubt anyone thought, well, this 8th century text by Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, is going to be a huge bestseller forever. You know, millions of copies have been sold, and still today it's incredibly, and there of course have been other versions in addition to the original one, but that's how it came to the West in English.
Mm. Now, did your great-grandfather, he was living in Darjeeling, and had he come there from Tibet? How did that all? I'm just wondering.
Our family had been in Darjeeling for a number, you know, for some generations.
Oh, really?
So, so far further back, our family came from Tibet, but they had been there, and he was born in that area in the 1800s. Mm. So he knew a lot of different people, and so he provided this letter of introduction. And so it was funny for me because as I became a writer, and I started working on a novel that was related to, it was based on my grandfather's funeral. Oh. And that's how I started researching the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And one thing that really struck me is that, of course, I was not reading it in the original Tibetan. And I was reading this Oxford edition that had been made possible partly by my great grandfather. And so I felt this was coming full circle. And here I was, you know, many, many years later, using it to write about to write this novel. And so the novel ended up being, I realized that I could structure it according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that's how I got started with researching or studying the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Did that novel come out?
That novel did not come out. It is as yet unpublished. I wrote it, and it's basically about Bardo, about, you know, the going through the Bardo from death to rebirth. The patriarch of the family is going from death to rebirth. And then the surviving family members are going through their own death and rebirth cycles as their own Bardo. Because Bardo, of course, is death to rebirth. It's also birth to death. It's any time when our ordinary reality is suspended. And so that was one of the things that was and remains very intriguing to me about the Book of the Dead, which is that it's meant to be as much for the living as for the dead.
Yeah.
And at first I didn't really understand that. I thought, well, how can that be? And I thought it was some kind of esoteric funerary text that I would look into and see if it had any relation. And then more and more I realized how much it really connected to my life and to our everyday lives. And so that wisdom lives on. It's remarkable to me how relevant it is.
Yeah. Well, there's also been how many great, great lamas have just entered into our lives in the West in a way that's been so profound for so many. I was fortunate myself to meet a number of them, and to see His Holiness doesn't travel anymore, but see him in the West, in the States all the time. So there's maybe we just get into the guts of it a little bit in terms of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and related to the structure of your book, because this is what you mentioned in that article. And so let's talk about the first part, which is coming to see, gee whiz, we're dead. when the consciousness principle, this is from a quote from that you quote from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, when the consciousness principle getteth outside the body, it saith to itself, am I dead or am I not dead? The text explains, it cannot determine, it sees its relatives and connections as it had been used to seeing them before. The deceased might take up to 4 days to acknowledge her death. She may hover about, calling to her relatives, why are you weeping? You want to talk about how you perceive that?
That really blew me away when I first read it, because I thought, if there's one thing that we should be able to realize, it's that we're dead. how can that
be a good thing?
It doesn't seem like a subtle thing. Like, okay, I'm dead. And and I, gosh, you know, what does this mean? And so the belief is that it takes up to 4 days for the deceased to realize this, and that they're hovering and bumping around the altar room, unless they're very enlightened, in which case they've moved on. But for most of us, we'd be hovering around and going like, over here, I'm over here. Why are you guys crying? Look, everything's okay. Don't cry. And the lamas who are reading from the Book of the Dead, they sit in the altar room and they read to the deceased next to the body. Are saying what you just said, what you just read, that partly they're saying that. They're saying, you have died. You have died, and you need to accept that. And the deceased, then the reason the idea is it takes up to 4 days is they're like, oh, no, I'm right here.
What do you mean?
There's been a terrible mistake. And that they can't understand. So at some point, they perhaps look in a mirror and they see there's no reflection, or they look down at the ground and they see that where they've walked, there are no footsteps. And then this, for most of us, terrible reality starts to dawn on them that in fact they have died. And one of the reasons that this was so intriguing to me is that, as I said, it relates very much to the living as well. And so the idea is that the surviving relatives who are sitting in the altar room listening to the prayers as well can think about how this applies to their own lives, right? And so you can think, okay, so one bardo is death to rebirth, and we need to accept that we're dead in order to move on. And another bardo is birth to death. And what kinds of ways might we actually be dead and not admitting it and not facing it? Right. And yeah, exactly. And so one of my not favorite in a feel good way, but very striking examples of this is, for example, let's say your marriage, let's say that your marriage is over, but a lot of people will cling on, they'll cling to the relationship, even though it's dead, rather than saying this is over. And so and that's one of the things I talk about in my book as well, is that we cling on to something, and here's the great paradox, right? We cling on to it even though there's nothing there.
Yeah. Which is, we can pick stuff out like that on a day-to-day basis. the clinging is extraordinary on the most minute to the largest issues, right? Okay, number two, we encounter frightening visions of deities and demons, projections from our subconscious that are like our dreams when we sleep. This is an opportunity for us to recognize that these apparitions, our perceptions, have no independent existence. And it says, whatever terrifying visions thou mayest see, the Tibetan Book of the Dead instructs, recognizing them to be thine own thought forms. And talk about what's necessary in the birth to death, never mind the bardos after death. Yeah. If one could recognize that in our day-to-day lives, these are projections. Whatever it is, your story you're telling yourself and whatever you're projecting about people and phenomena. So that's where these two things, that is so self-evident and so powerful, huh?
It is. And this idea, because we think, we assume that what we see is real. And Evans Wentz writes something quite striking and poetic in the preface to the book, where he says that he calls them airy nothings woven into dreams.
Yeah, I love that. Airy nothings.
That.
Everybody, just when you get that going, just go, airy nothings, just like a dream.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a dream. And so, and you know how, so when we sleep and our dreams can be so vivid and feel so real, and it's like that, right? And so the things that we think are real, and in this case, if we're looking at, for example, a frightening vision of using the bardo idea from the Book of the Dead, from death to rebirth, if you see a frightening deity, for example, that it has no external tangible existence, right? It's just something, it's a projection of a fear that you have, right? And it becomes embodied. when you're looking, it becomes embodied because you think that it's real, right? And as soon as you realize it's not, it just disappears. And so the same thing, the fears that we have, as you say, from birth to death.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's, again, just so plain and simple that that's why we practice, you know, on this podcast and on a lot of the others that happen on Be Here Now Network. There's always, from teachers, a call to practice now while you still can. And that is exactly one of the major insights that one can get to with practice. And it's the day-to-day that it helps with, and of course, going through the death part. And the third part is about judgment and rebirth. This is interesting. We appear before Yama, the Lord of Death, who holds a mirror, which is our memory. Good deeds are weighed against bad on Yama's scale, which is our conscience, and the nature of our existence going forward is decided. If the scale weighs, you're full of sin, your grandma used to say to you, right? In hot boiling oil, this she used to say to the, oh my God, you're thrown, and your body is roasted with all the burns, you're finished.
My it's not good.
Grandmother never said anything like that.
Yeah, she was very matter of fact, and she'd with her hand, she'd be like, "With all the birds, you're finished." She's like that. So yes, this is very interesting, and this has to do. I love this idea, and of course, it's present in other traditions and religions and so on as well, of judgment. Mm. And so this idea that we come up and the. It's all, again, it's not like Yama is actually an external person or entity. It's all inside us. So it's our memory and our conscience. It's our memory and our conscience. So we're saying, so let's say I remember when I cheated a friend and really caused a lot of suffering to that friend. And then my conscience would make, well, then that this is the day of reckoning, right? Where you say, okay, I did this. Do I take responsibility for it? Do I acknowledge that, you know, rather than being like, well, you know, it probably was all the ways we justify these things. So, and then if you are able to face yourself and say, at the end of the day, I lived well, I did the right thing overall, then the white stones are going to come out in your favor. And the idea. And otherwise, there's that burning oil waiting for you.
Brimstone. Ooh. Now we have to say one of the there is a reason why these lamas get together after one has died and sits with the deceased for actually, and they do prayers for what, 40 something days? I'm not sure.
It varies. In my grandmother's case, I went to her funeral in Darjeeling, and in her case, it was determined by the death horoscope. And so when someone dies, traditionally, there's a death horoscope that's cast, and it says how long the prayer should go on for, what types of prayers they should be to remove obstacles, and when the cremation should take place. And then the 49th day, there's another ceremony.
Mm. 49, later, but that's the, it, yeah.
49th day ceremony, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
But the poa, the prayer, is recited regularly, and everyone can recite it. And it has, first of all, you're bringing the Buddha into your third eye, and you are visualizing him, and then you are asking, "Forgive me for anything I harmed anybody." And there's a whole series of different prayers that one goes through that are recited so you can remember. We, instead of Buddha in this particular case, because of our relationship with our guru, Neem Karoli Baba, you can bring in anybody who is free. Basically, you want it to be a free being that had no longer been caught in any, gone beyond duality, basically. So there's a very great prescribed thing. Now, we knew in the West, of course, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, Sogyal Rinpoche, which is a great book, no matter what happened to that lama, which is a whole other thing. I think the book is great, instructive, easy to read for Westerners, and really translates some important things about how to deal with all of this. And just so for your edification out there, I know this is a touchy subject, and I don't really know how to handle it because this lama was accused of various improprieties. But I do know that that book has helped so many people. Again, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and particularly there are prayers in there that he translated into a little bit more common, grounded, Western way to understand and be able to say them. So that's just an aside on that one.
It's very well, and that book, I agree, is immensely helpful to so many people and continues to be, regardless of, as you say, what went on with Soyo Rinpoche. And I think that one of the things it does as well, I think he says in that book that in a way, you know, dying is very simple. You just breathe in and you breathe out and you don't breathe in again. Mm. And my grandmother also was very, very matter of fact about it. She was not afraid of dying. And she, from her point of view, to be afraid of dying would have been, it's like being afraid that the sun is going to set or that the sun is going to rise, or it's just part of the normal cycle of, or being afraid of being born, or, you know, just the normal things that happen. And so it's more a question of, and again, I think it's very much relevant to our birth to death life, journey or bardo, which is it's how we go through it. It's how we go through it that we can decide. And that's very much, again, what the Tibetan Book of the Dead is about, which is that it's not like, I mean, hopefully we don't just hurtle through it like we're, you know, catapulted through space, but that we go through it consciously and intentionally with what we've learned so that we can move forward in the best way.
Yeah. More fodder for practice.
That's in reality. Right.
So here's something from, you can help shed some light here, Anne. And this is from the Evans Wentz that has the intro by John Woodruff. And it was written a couple of years before the book was published, actually. And he makes some different comments. And there's a couple of things that really attracted me. I used to bring it up with Ram Dass in particular, because he was, although he had studied forever in different Buddhist traditions, by the end of his life, he used to say, well, there's a way in which the clarity, the extraordinary clarity of Buddhist thought and vision of reality, basically, is so entrapping. He said, I have seen so many people get entrapped in their minds around this and forget their hearts. And that's what, so of course we used to have at every retreat in Maui, all of our Buddhist friends, right? From Roshi Joan Halifax to Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salisbury, on and on, all of them. And whenever soul would come up, he'd look at them and go, sorry, we had to bring up the soul thing. And then I read in this version what that he got into some kind of getting at an understanding of what that thing is that incarnates. And it's, you know, as far as the Buddhists are, it's not a self thing that does. And he called it soul complex, ever changing, constantly changing as a human changes in life and evolves. That is what's very much part of what, have you ever heard that term? I mean, I was so far out to hear what he called a soul complex.
I have not heard it. Yeah. No,
oh,
it's
really?
Very interesting to hear, but it certainly resonates.
He talks about the soul complex emerges from its experience of the void into a state like that of a dream. This continues until it attains a new fleshly body and thus really awakes to earth life again. So he was in the last stage of the bardo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's more. Yeah. He just refers over and over. Death disincarnates the soul complex as birth incarnates it. In other words, death is itself only an initiation into another form of life than that of which it is the ending. And the nature of the death consciousness determines the future state of the soul complex, existence being the continuous transformation of one's conscious state into another. That's basically what he's saying. I mean, I was so fascinated by this that it starts to speak to there can only be one thing going on and different traditions describe it differently, right? So, that just struck me.
And it really, what you just read really relates to our journey through life and how we, as we move, you know, in that one of the great ironies, I think, is that we really are afraid of death, most of us, and whether it's during life or whether it's actual death of our bodies. And yet we can move into, as you were just reading, you know, if we accept it and move on, we can move into a really different and wonderful state of existence.
Right. This constant change is not a bad thing, you know, and that's,
it's not
that's
a bad thing. Yeah. And also it's, there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah. Which is a reality thing.
Yeah, the universe doesn't care if we think it's good or bad. Yeah. You know, it just is, right?
Right. How about this? Yeah. At the moment of death, the empiric consciousness or consciousness of objects is lost. There is what is popularly called a swoon. Have you heard about the swoon? That's something else
I've seen that in the Evans Wentz Tibetan Book of the Dead. It says that they're in a swoon for 4 days, give or take, until they wake up and realize they're dead.
He says, however, this is the corollary of superconsciousness itself or the clear light of the void. For the swoon is in and of the consciousness as knower of objects. This empiric consciousness disappears, unveiling pure consciousness. I think this is the biggest thing about trying to describe what happens, which is ever ready to be discovered by those who have the will to seek and the power to find it. I have a hard time with the will to seek and power to find it. I'm going to depend more on Neem Karoli Baba in that moment, my guru. But the reality. So here's the question after all of this, Anne. I'm so sorry. This is not easy stuff, okay?
No, it's not. So
there is always, as one goes along through these bardos, you seem to have an option to go in one direction or another, they talk of. Where does that, I mean, if it's true, and I have to, I mean, I believe this, that, you know, empiric consciousness disappears. There's not this self thinker that we're on the, you know, in our lives day to day, you know, this is our, you know, our movie of me, we call it. That's gone. So what is making choices relative to consciousness and self-referential anything, which has to disappear? What's your thoughts?
It's a good question, and I don't know. I don't know the answer to that in terms of the death to rebirth. There is an idea that some kind of essence, you know, is remaining and moving forward, whether or not it's consciousness.
But also making choices of some sort.
Exactly, right? And so you
That's
can always
the real,
make, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting, right? And so you're like, oh, you can choose to face reality and admit that you've died, or you can choose to take responsibility for this really bad thing you did during your life and with your conscience and accept that and move on. So yeah, what is that? I don't know. And the way that I think of it and have thought of it in my writing as well as I think of it in my life is that we make those choices. you know, we make those choices as we go through life, and that we are always, and this is one of the fascinating things to me about the idea of Bardo and the Bardo Total and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is that we create our experience in the Bardo. And so it's not just some static thing that we go through, but that, and in the same thing in our lives, right? So our lives is a Bardo. So whatever you, Raghu, or I, Anne, do right now, or tonight, or tomorrow, or next year, will then, of course, influence or determine what comes after that. And we make those choices. And so it's very, and one of the things I really love too, and I mentioned it in the Tricycle essay, is that I love how it's not, it could be really, I mean, obviously it's a very harsh reality to accept, right? That one is dead, but it's, there's so much compassion in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, and it's the idea. And is, for example, when my grandmother died, the monks are there 24/7, 24 hours a day. They're in the altar room next to her body, reading to her from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And if one goes to take a break, then another one comes to take his place. And so the idea, and the idea there is that you are never alone. And I love that, right? And so it's like, this is really hard. This is really hard. It's like the hardest thing probably that we're ever going to have to face. But we got you. It's kind of like that, you know, we got this, you know, Guru Rinpoche, now the monks. This is really hard, but we all go through it. And here is encouragement and support and wisdom to help you go through in the best way.
And if you don't have the opportunity to be in a community of monks or with people, teachers that really know how to conduct these rituals, you can get it on a simpler basis of, and what you said, it rings more true than anything. You are not alone. And one thing that one would hope in terms of family and so on and friends, that the clinging isn't so extraordinary that there's no way that there's a release. And rather, hey, this is a beautiful opportunity to move on. The love I have for you is not going to change. The love you have for me, nothing will change. We are in that envelope for eternity, and we've been doing this stuff together in different ways and incarnating. So that can happen without there being a official ritualized ceremony on a day. I mean, that's fantastic. And I've known people who have had that opportunity where the local Tibetan monastery will send over people, really, and do that with you and with the family.
And one of the things that the Book of the Dead talks about is setting the deceased face to face with reality, that they use that terminology, setting face to face. And it always astonishes me how we incline towards denial. It's just, I always think, well, I have studied this for years. I've studied this book and I understand the idea, you know, and then that turning away from reality obviously doesn't make the reality go away. You know, it reminds me of in a way how my children used to play hide and seek, you know, when they were little, and their idea of hiding was to go like this, like without standing there. Right? And it's all still there. Right. And we tend to turn away from it. And it's one of the things that I wrote, as I say, wrote about in my novel, as well as in my new memoir, which is that as we go through, let's say, the birth to death Bardo, as we go through that journey, and my memoir is about a journey I took to India with my mother, and I'm looking into my family history, my past growing up Tibetan American, my relationship with my mother, and then this wisdom that is passed down through the generations from my great-grandfather, grandmother, my mother, me, my daughter. And that this idea of us as pilgrims, right, as pilgrims, you know, walking this path as we go forward through life is very powerful. And where we can, as I say, not be in denial and say, this is the truth, or this is what's happening in this relationship, or you know, whatever it may be. And then what? And that's where what you said about choice comes in. So what choices do we want to make around this? And one of the things I also wrote about in the essay that you mentioned is the story about my great-grandfather. And he, when he was coming down one day in 1912 from Tibet to India, back to Darjeeling from Lhasa, and he had been working in Lhasa to set up a police force, and that the 13th Dalai Lama had asked him to set up. So he was coming back down, and he got caught in an avalanche, and the whole party, most of the party was buried. And so he was buried, and he was very devout, a very devout Buddhist and follower of Guru Rinpoche. So he was praying to him, and he managed somehow to stick his hand up through the snow with his prayer beads. And the search party, the men who were above ground, saw him, and they pulled him out.
Amazing.
And that story, one of the interesting things too, is that the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a terma, what's called a terma, which is a treasure teaching, as you know. And the idea is that Guru Rinpoche buried these treasure teachings around Tibet and other places when he was establishing Buddhism in the 8th century. And you can't just go dig them out with a shovel. It's not like, oh, here's one, you know, you know, get the shovel. Because they're buried in caves, they're buried in trees, they're buried in the sky, in dreams, which I love, and in the mind stream, right? And the mind stream really speaks for me to this particular story with my great-grandfather. And so this story came down to me through my grandmother of how he had survived. And he was the only one who survived of all the people who were buried. And that he was essentially, Bardo also refers to any time that your ordinary reality is suspended. So it could be illness, it could be an accident. And so he was in Bardo, entombed in the snow there, and he made a choice. This goes back to what we're talking about with choice. So he could have said, he could have been in denial and said, "Nah, it's probably okay. You know, this probably isn't as bad as it looks," or, you know, and you really have a very short time to live if you're buried in an avalanche. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, or he could have said, "Oh, you know, this is really not, this is bad. I wish this hadn't happened. You know, I wish I was, you know, riding down as usual to India." And instead he accepted the really dire nature of his situation. And then he made a choice, right, and took some action. And that to me really speaks to the lesson, which is at the heart of the Book of the Dead. And the one reason I find the Tibetan Book of the Dead so moving is that it's about facing reality, but not giving up. Right? And so we don't say, "Oh yeah, this reality is really bad. There's nothing I can do." We're like this. And I think this speaks to the pandemic as well, you know, and so that this whole bardo of COVID that we've been in,
yeah.
Right. Where we can say like, this is really bad.
Yeah.
It's a really bad situation, but we're not going to give up. And how can we move through this in the most meaningful and authentic way?
Yeah. And the way in which when we go through the death bardo that we fear happens and you turn away it's just exactly an anomaly for going through day-to-day life, and stuff comes up and we do a lot of turning away instead of turning to and surrendering and opening in and whatever word you want to use. And that's, to me, the great lesson is that it is not just, in fact, it's, again, starting to have that perspective now when you're, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old, start there. And we went to India when I was, the bunch of us that went over at that time, we were in our early 20s and late teens. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate, obviously, the karma was really ripe for us. But start there is what I say. Start turning towards rather than turning away and recognizing. I mean, that's a lot of what the Tibetan Book of the Dead is about. It's recognizing what is rather than projecting and doing all the sorts of things that we do to not be here now. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I really agree with that wholeheartedly. And the interestingly, it always seemed hard and still does, of course, to me. Sometimes it seems hard to face reality. You're like, oh, you know, it's too hard, it's too painful, it's too much suffering, I'm going to turn away. But interestingly, the times when I have faced it, and when I do face it, whatever it may be, yeah. it's actually very freeing. Mm. And that was a real revelation for me, right? You know what I mean? Because then you're clearing out, out that construct from your mind.
Yeah.
So you can see what is.
Yeah. I know we're close to the end here, but, well, I don't have any real time, but the sponsor says you have 60 minutes, but you talk about turning in one direction or another. We must mention this extraordinary event in your life of getting ill with something that couldn't be diagnosed. It's a very, I know it's a long story, but I think if tell us a little, share a little bit, certainly around the way in which at some point there was a turning to and not a turning away. Initially, I know there was a turning away.
There really was. And what happened is I woke up one morning here in Tokyo, very, very, very ill. I had incredibly high fever, chills, nausea, headaches, so on and so forth. I ended up being hospitalized, and for 9 days, they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I'll never forget, the doctor came to see me one evening, and I thought, now we're finally going to get down to it, because they had done like dengue, malaria, all these different tests, and nothing had come back positive. And so he folded his arms and he leaned against the windowsill, and he said, we have no idea what's wrong with you. And we just stared at each other. I'll never forget. It was about 8:30 at night. And we just were looking at each other.
How old were you then?
I was in my 40s.
Oh, you were in your 40s.
I was in my 40s, mother of two children, university professor, writer. I had a whole life. And suddenly I was just thrown off that, out of that life into this bardo, basically. And then the next day, suddenly they came rushing in. And one of the blood tests that they had taken had shown that I had something called endocarditis. Mm-hmm. And endocarditis is an infection of your heart lining. And apparently the bacteria had grown to such a degree in my heart valve that it had almost closed it off entirely. And they said they were amazed I was still alive and that I hadn't had a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So I was put onto intravenous antibiotics. And if anybody would like to know the full story of this, there's an essay I wrote called Traveling in Bardo, which is online in Agni magazine.
And we'll have it in the show notes. So everybody can have all the links to some of the blogs and so on.
And I was terrified because I made a mistake of, it's very much academic writer kind of behavior, probably, as I Googled. I Googled endocarditis and it was terrifying. You know, it said all these terrible complications and that you could be paralyzed and you could have heart failure and organ damage. And then it said significant mortality. So it seemed like I was getting better and my husband and I were very hopeful. And the, they call it vegetation in your heart valve had decreased quite a bit by a couple of days after the antibiotics. And so we were thrilled. And I was already in my mind packing up my room. We're going to go to Kyoto to like get over all this. And, you know, and the doctor was not at all happy. He was clearly really worried. And so we said, you know, what's wrong? And he said that what was likely is that, in fact, some of the vegetation had broken off and was traveling through my bloodstream and could lodge somewhere else in my body and create an embolism and basically kill me. So we just hoped for the best. And then the next morning when I woke up, one of my fingers was numb. And so I had a CAT scan and so on. And what turned out is indeed he was right. And this had gone and it lodged in the occipital lobe of my brain and was killing the surrounding tissue in my brain. And I'll never forget, they showed us the picture of this right on the screen of my, this black spot on my brain. And I couldn't even look at it anymore. I just left in my wheelchair. I walked and left my husband to talk to the doctor. And when I got back to my room, my husband, who is a real hero, he had brought these papers and left them by the thing. It was like school papers. He's a teacher, a professor as well. And so I just kind of idly riffled through them. And in the back of that folder was my living will. Mm. And so I thought, gosh, you know, so he wasn't telling me, but obviously they had told him to bring it or, you know, and to make sure everything was in order. And so I thought, wow, I'm going to be one of those moms who dies in their 40s. Like, this is, I've got these young kids, I've got a life, and I'm just like in, and it's, that's it, I'm probably done. And when I was lying in my room, and I remember looking up at the white ceiling of the room, and I thought of this story of my great grandfather buried in the snow, and how, and it deeply encouraged me, because I thought, you know, because the reality, as you're saying, of course I wanted to turn away from it. I'd be like, well, it's probably not that bad. The doctors will save me. You know, and it was actually that bad. It was really bad. And they had never even had a case like mine before, right, at this hospital. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, you know, really wanting to push it away and just think about somehow getting back to the life that I had had. And it really reminds me of what we talked about, the first stage of Bardo after you die, of coming to realize you're dead, and where you long for your previous life. Like, oh, you know, I want it back, and you can't have it back. And I really wanted my life back. I wanted to just pack my stuff and go home and get back to my life, and it wasn't going to happen. So my great-grandfather's story really encouraged me. And that's what I mean too about Mindstream, is that I feel like it came to me through our family's Mindstream. You know, I had heard it many years before and hadn't thought about it at all. And now it came to me about how he was, near death, buried in the snow. And I felt like I was in a similar kind of white tomb, and saved himself. And I thought, you know, so I could face this. I can say, yeah, this is really bad. And also, and not give up hope. And the other thing I really realized from this experience was about impermanence. And I had written about it so much. But it's very different from actually experiencing it, I found. And I had never entirely understood that, because it seemed like, yes, of course, admit that you're dead. Of course, move on. You know, it is what it is. But the reality of it was so much more difficult than I thought, and so much more painful. Exactly. The attachment. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And to my children, to my husband, mm-hmm. to our life, and to my life. And so I really, one of the things the Book of the Dead says is that we are pilgrims in search of a lost harmony. And I always thought that meant we were searching for the harmony that we lost because we lost our previous life. And I understood it really differently after this experience in the hospital, which is that it was the harmony we lose when we forget that impermanence is the central truth of our existence.
Mm, that's so beautiful. Then,
and it really, really, I really, that just broke over me like a wave, you know, that realization that I had been pushing that away and be like, no impermanence, right? But it is the central truth of our existence. And as I said before, it was very, it was very freeing to say, like, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. Yes, impermanence. And it's going to come to all of us. And I really realized that. And so my great-grandfather's story encouraged me and it helped me not to lose hope, and also to realize I might not live. I mean, he happened to live, and there was no certainty at all that I was going to make it. But that I could do is I could determine how I went through it. And that was the pivot or the shift that I was able to make. I thought, yeah, because partly, you know, I'm like, oh, I want to fix this. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to live. But we can't do that. What we can say is, okay, here's how I'm going to travel through this part of.
Right. What a great story. And thank God it all came out so that you're here with us talking about it. Right?
Yes, I'm really grateful.
Oh, that's so great, Anne. So, boy, we could go on, huh?
We could. This is just the beginning.
Well, we'll have to do more podcasts.
Definitely. Yeah. I look forward to it.
Yeah. So, of course, everybody, we're going to put links into many of the, of course, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Evans Wentz version. I don't even know if this is available anymore. It's from Wisdom Books India. I must have gotten it when I was in India a long time ago. But we'll end our Anne's website and as well as articles and so on. And we'll have to look for the memoir when it comes. And I just thank you so much for being here. Being here meaning Tokyo here and in California. It's amazing, huh?
And thank you, Raghu.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. Absolutely wonderful meeting you. Everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And if you don't know about it yet, we have Alan Watts now on the network. So enjoy, and we will talk to you next week. You'll hear from us, that's for sure. Bye-bye.